Of all the features that make you unlike anybody else, the single most unique is probably your voice. Our voices are shaped by age, culture, language, sex, and lifestyle so that no two are exactly alike. They can change volume, tone, and pitch, adaptable enough to scare away a predator and lull a baby to sleep on the same night. It's time we stopped taking our voices for granted. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. John Colapinto makes his living as a journalist, these days at The New Yorker. But he's one of those people lucky enough to just have such a good singing voice that he was recruited to be lead singer of the company house band formed by the owner of Rolling Stone magazine, where he worked at the time. Colapinto never had any formal training. When a song called for him to roar, growl, or wail over guitars and drums at full volume, his voice somehow always just did so. Until a bout of post-rehearsal laryngitis persisted as a kind of permanent rasp, requiring him to strain his voice even more just to make himself heard. It took him a while to even acknowledge he needed help, but once he did, he found himself fascinated not just with the therapies offered to help him rehabilitate his own voice, but with the astonishing power we all have to make our thoughts and our feelings understood. He writes about all this in his book, This is the Voice. He joined me in February to talk about it. John, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much, Chris.
You seem to have been in some denial about the extent of your vocal injury. How did it affect you just trying to go through daily life?
Yeah, I was really in total denial. I mean, the voice that I have to be most concerned with is the one that I produce on the page as a writer. But I also interviewed people all the time for my stories. And, you know, I began to realize that having a voice that sounded like rough and kind of the way it does even now with a rasp and some rattle to it was putting across a different person across the phone line than I used to put across. And that sort of made me self-conscious. I thought I maybe sounded to people like I was a heavy cigarette smoker and a guy that was into the bourbon at 2 in the afternoon, and which is not true of me. But also just what was explained to me by this voice doctor who I actually did a story on, Steven Zeitel's, was that really I was retraining my voice to deal with the injury, and I was putting it into a register that was lower. So it wasn't quite my usual register, and it was also less melodically elastic. I was not going up and down with the ease that others do. And so he said I was sounding more monotonic, and this really threw me. He also mentioned correctly that I probably was withdrawing from situations where there was a lot of noise, loud cocktail parties, concerts, where I had to speak over the noise, because I would know that I would be even raspier for like the next week. So there were ways in which this was changing who I was projecting into the world, but also how I was behaving in the world. And that was rather stunning to me to be sort of have that explained to me.
So why were you not keen to have surgery to correct that right away?
Yeah, you know, when it was suggested to me, I was told that it would be actually quite an elaborate operation. You know, you go into the hospital for a few days. It's actually a very, I don't want to say dangerous operation, but it's risky in that your voice can emerge worse. Hmm. That's how delicate it is. They're reaching down your throat with these instruments on like knitting needle extensions, and they're operating through a stereo microscope. But also it was going to require 6 weeks of total vocal silence after the operation. When it was first suggested to me, I was at a stage of my life and career where that just seemed impossible. I had a new baby, had a new apartment, had to keep working, and I do rely on my voice for interviews and so on. And then, yeah, so I mean, that really was my excuse, my rationale.
I've been working in radio for most of my career, so I'm a little ashamed to admit that I didn't really know the term prosody before I picked up this book. Mm-hmm. Can you explain what it has to do with the way we sort of tell everybody else who we are?
Well, you just said the way that we tell everybody else, which was lovely because you have a nice elastic voice. That's the melody of speech, prosody or prosody. It depends on how you want to pronounce it. And it's from the ancient Greek. It's two words, pro, toward, sody, song, prosody. So we speak towards song. And in fact, if we don't speak with quite a bit of song in our voice, people get extremely bored listening to us. They are turning off their radios now. So I've got to go back to having some prosody in my voice. We really do this with rhythm. You know, we're kind of rapping all the time. So there's rhythmic, we're punching consonants in kind of a cool rhythm to keep people interested and attentive, where our voice is going up and down to express emotional parts of our speech. It's also to tuck in an embedded phrase. We'll kind of drop our voice and get it down there, and then we go back up to the main part. So we're doing all of that, and we all of us are exquisite singers without really knowing it, because we learn it so young.
The fact that babies learn to talk is one of those miracles that we somehow completely overlook because we just expect it. What do babies learn about speech before they've even emerged from the womb?
Oh, yeah, it's great. They're hearing so much of that prosody, actually. They're hearing primarily from their mom's voice. And the reason why I say that is because obviously her mouth and so on is closer to the baby because she's in the, you know, right there. But the sound waves reach the baby not just through the air, you know, penetrating her abdominal wall. The voice actually travels down her skeleton in the form of bone conduction, so that the amniotic fluid that the baby or fetus is in is actually vibrating against the body. So the first outside stimulus that any baby gets in that dark womb is actually this human voice, like vibrating against every part of them. So the lessons being learned there in how the voice goes up and down and how it speeds up and slows down are actually indelible. They know that from testing of babies when they're born, very interesting tests that were devised. And once the baby's born into this bath of language that's all around it, all of a sudden the hearing is sharper. Now they can hear vowels and consonants more clearly because they're kind of, it's just sort of a rumble when they're in the womb. Now they're picking up all of these other sounds in the speech and signal, and really it's shaping their brains. We now know that it's literally forming connections and circuitry within the brain that is specifically geared to the language, the native language that they will be speaking. And certain circuitry that's not needed, let's say if it's an English baby as opposed to one that would be raised speaking Swahili, the English baby prunes away the circuits that a Swahili would use. So it's fascinating how the brain is actually being sculpted by the sounds that the baby is hearing all around it.
Here is Adela Smith, who's two, just chatting away to herself. Thanks to her aunt, our producer, Ana Perez, by the way, for picking up that audio. I couldn't make out a word there, John, but talk about how babies practice speaking before they can form words that anybody else understands.
Well, what's so great about that was it still sounded like English. It sounded, because it has those rhythmic and melodic contours. So the prosody is actually learned first. And that's something that Darwin, of all people, noticed first in his own baby. He wrote a baby diary where he noted down his surprise in realizing, because he was such a good observer, that those sort of swoops of melody that might accompany a question or a statement or surprise were all in the voice as clearly as someone speaking, but the actual vowels and consonants were essentially nonsense. So we really do lay down those prosodic features first, which is kind of counterintuitive. We think, oh, when's my baby going to speak her first word? Oh, has she spoken her first word? Well, she may not have spoken her first word, but she's done a lot of English speaking, because actually the prosodic contours of English are different than French and different from German. So parents should start boasting even earlier, oh, my baby's speaking already, even if she can't be understood.
So before we move on from this, there is one astonishing fact about language acquisition that I want you to touch on. How fast do kids acquire words in the first 15 years of their life?
Oh, it's absolutely stunning. Like, they're learning something like, and I wish I knew the exact, I've gone ahead and forgotten, but like, it's some ridiculous number per hour, like 4 or 5 per hour, every hour for 15 years. And they know that because there's like we all have a library or a dictionary of like, I forget how many thousands, hundreds of thousands of words by the time we're 15. And this means we're learning them at this incredible rate. But the most astonishing thing was an experiment that was done with kids, like pre-verbal children, that were shown a mystery object on a screen. And they were told, that's a Dax, Dax. And the experimenter would point at Dax. And then they did not say that to the kid again for 2 weeks. And they showed it to the kid on the screen. The kid goes, Dax. I mean, these are kids that already have some verbal, but the retention, the speed of acquisition is something that no scientist ever really guessed at. I would say Darwin is actually the first to have suggested that we don't have language inborn. We don't have a language instinct. We have an instinct to learn that is ferocious. That cliche that a baby's brain is a sponge is really no joke. And that Dax experiment is just a jaw dropper.
So here is Scarlett Johansson in the movie Her, where she plays a character that is completely the product of artificial intelligence.
What do I call you? Do you have a name?
Yes. Samantha.
Hey, where'd you get that name from?
I gave it to myself, actually.
How come?
Because I like the sound of it. Samantha.
Wait, when did you give it to yourself?
Well, right when you asked me if I had a name, I thought, yeah, he's right, I do need a name. But I wanted to pick a good one. So I read a book called How to Name Your Baby, and out of 180,000 names, that's the one I like the best.
That was also Joaquin Phoenix in that scene. You know, that movie, of course, is science fiction, John. But I'm curious about how actual scientists are trying to understand prosody in human speech so they can give it to Siri and Alexa and other computer voices.
Yes, it's something that they've been recently really going after because it's sort of the final frontier of making simulated speech sound like human beings. That was such a great example because Scarlett begins her first answer by saying, and then there's a little rasp on one of her words and there's a lot of elasticity. And all of those little features, the kind of pauses and ums and ers, are actually something called paralinguistics. Paralanguage was dreamed up in the 50s, that term. And so what scientists are now trying to do is give our computers not only the beautiful elasticity of how we speak with emotion and, you know, grammatical changes with melody, they're also trying to put in those pauses and those ums and ers because we forget how much those make us human. The question is, how on earth do they do it? Now, it used to be that they would sort of, you know, actually, they were nowhere close to being able to do it. I better just say that until machine learning came along, which is really instead of someone sitting at a terminal inputting all sorts of information, like when someone's angry, their speech speeds up. So let me just code that in. And then their voice might get a little higher. Let me code that in. I mean, you would be sitting in that terminal for a million years and you would never have the beautiful complexity of our prosodic and paralinguistic voices. But with machine learning, you write an algorithm that teaches the computer to teach itself, which is actually what happened to us in the womb. I mentioned we're doing all that listening and it's getting into our brains and sculpting our brains. Well, what they do with these algorithms that of machine learning is they actually play like unbelievable amounts of human speech into the computer's listening device, and the computer sorts it out for themselves, starts to match anger with an angry tone. I mean, the emotion has to be labeled by the scientists. That's the tricky part. But, you know, they're getting better and better at this. I mean, at this point, computers certainly understand, as well as humans do, the broad emotions like anger, happiness, you know, those kind of broad emotions. They're incredibly good at hearing. And that means they're going to be soon incredibly good at producing those sounds. So our computers won't sound like, you know, Hal in 2001. They're going to sound more like me, going up and down and pausing and making mistakes.
I'm not sure how I feel about that.
Yeah, I know. A lot of people are extremely nervous about it because we saw even how sort of crude chat bots and other sort of mischief-making computer bots affected the Brexit vote in 2016, the presidential election of 2016. So now just imagine, you know, these sort of deep fake voices. It's going to be a bit of a free-for-all, perhaps. Yeah.
One really interesting facet of human voices is that they are essentially identical in boys and girls. And then after puberty, men's voices get a lot lower than women's so that we can usually distinguish whether someone is male or female, even over the phone. What might be the reasons for that according to evolution?
Yeah, I mean, the belief is that male voices descended the way that they did because when we want to mate, there's two different things going on in the animal kingdom. One of them is that we have attractive ornaments, a peacock's tail, for instance, or a bird's beautiful song. A male songbird seduces the female. But there's also this thing that Darwin actually pointed out called contest competition, because you're not there just as the male to do all this seductive vocal stuff, because there's another male that wants to. So what males of non-human animals do is the males compete with each other. It tends to be the males that do this. So stags grow big, huge horns and ram each other's heads together. Roosters grow these, hideous like things on their claws, and they claw each other and so on. Now, human beings and our early human ancestors didn't have those special weapons that we would kill each other with, but the voice itself is a weapon. If you think about it, when you lower it, you sound more dominating, you sound more threatening and hostile. Why? Because it creates the illusion that you're bigger. I mentioned before a little violin and a big acoustic bass. Well, that's because, so you're actually giving an illusion. It's a size bluff. And actually, when you're feeling loving and want someone to not feel threatened, you raise your voice and you sound more like a violin. And you do that even if you're 6'2", like me. So we're doing all of these size bluffs around with our voices. So that's a huge part of what's happening.
So do deeper male voices provide some kind of reproductive advantage? Do women prefer a partner with a deep voice?
They do to an extent. What they've discovered actually is that one of the things that we believe females are hearing is that the person has the male has had like a lot of testosterone. Testosterone actually strengthens immune systems. So the feeling is that your babies that you have will be more disease resistant. That would be a big plus to a deep voice. But evolution, of course, takes place over such a long period of time that other lessons are learned at the same time. And one of the lessons that women seem to have learned, we'll call them females at this point, because I'm talking now about sort of pre-humans, actually, they would have learned that someone that's over-testosteronized, if that's a word,
we can all picture that, yeah.
You know what I'm talking about. That person may be a little violent. And maybe heading out to look for other females to mate with instead of sticking around to look after the child that they produce together. So really the feeling is that sort of females over this long span of time learn to like low voices, but not too low. So they sort of selected as mates guys whose voices were in a particular deep range. And of course, if they select those as mates, their babies, if they're boys, have that deep voice, have voices in that range because it's genetically determined. And the belief is that's how we sort of develop the range of male speech that we currently have.
In the modern world, women sometimes will complain that our voices are policed in a way that men's aren't. Here is Kim Kardashian and her famous vocal fry.
You know, Kanye didn't have a phone for 4 years. So it was really, especially when we first started dating, it was like rude if we brought our phones with us out.
Wow, perfect.
People grouse about this, John. In women, I was surprised to read in your book, actually, if you listen, men do it more.
Incredibly enough, yes, men are doing it all the time. But because we're less surprised to hear that very, very low range coming out from between male lips, it doesn't stick out as readily. But if you listen to George Clooney, if you listen to Leonardo DiCaprio, they descend into that range as well, that particular fry, which is a specific thing we do with the vocal cords. We stiffen them so that the air passes through in this crackling, popping way. And yes, women take an incredible amount of heat for that. But I mean, I gotta say, like researching this book, I thought, how can women speak that they don't get criticized? I mean, oh, Hillary Clinton sounds shrill, or this or that person sound, this woman sounds this or that way. And sometimes you do think that you really can't win. So that, but I think that's changing, to be honest. I think the more women are in positions of power and the more women are elected to elective office and we hear them speaking, the less do we hear these criticisms. And I think of someone like Elizabeth Warren, who you wouldn't necessarily say has an ideal politician's voice, but we're all totally used to it. She's not criticized for it. And this is kind of a lovely thing that happens through any exposure, societal exposure to different people, different modes of being, different skin colors. It's all wonderful and good because it makes us accustomed to it. We know we're not so critical.
You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Have women's voices responded to social cues over time as we've entered the workplace and tried to gain equivalent power and status to men's?
Fascinatingly have, yes. And a study shows that over 100 years, women, starting actually in 1920 with the suffrage movement, when it got the vote for women across Western societies, women's voices, recordings show, started to go down in pitch. And then with the Second World War, when women were suddenly occupying positions in their workplace, positions of authority, because the men had gone off to fight, their voices descended still more. And of course, movies from the 1940s show those really cool, wisecracking dames that are tough gals. And famously, Lauren Bacall, sure, in To Have and Have Not, with her lovely deep voice. You know, and that sort of became a thing. All of a sudden, women sounded like badasses, and that was all good. Because, you know, suddenly they were on the radio, as a matter of fact. They took over radio positions that for men that were off fighting, and they had to lower their voices a little bit because the equipment didn't handle a higher pitched voice as well. So they were kind of deliberately going into a lower register. But this was really viral and contagious for women across society, and they started to pick it up. They realized, hey, this is a way to be more authoritative, you know. And so it's fascinating. And these things happen subconsciously in all of us.
All right, here is Senator Bernie Sanders.
During the last 4 to 5 months during the pandemic, over 30 million Americans have lost their jobs. Many of them are struggling to put food on their table. They're worried about evictions. They're worried about being able to pay for health care. That's the reality for working families all across this country. But during this pandemic, there is another reality, and that is that the top 400...
All right, we all know he's lived in Vermont since he was 27 years old. John, why does Bernie Sanders still talk like he never left Brooklyn?
Well, that's because we really do get wired in for the sounds of our parents' language and the language of our neighborhood, the speech of our neighborhood, when we're very, very young. These things get sort of set in the brain. And I don't mean kind of figuratively. They get set in the brain in terms of literally the circuitry that we grow, the motor circuits that control how we move our lips and tongue. So he says, caw. And he says New York because he's not pronouncing that R. And by the time you're 27, I mean, he might as well have been 87 because really these things are kind of set by, at least by puberty. You probably still have some plasticity, you know, by 12. But really after that, no. You know, our accents are pretty much locked in unless we work very, very hard to change them. And we can, through dint of hard training, change our accents, but it's not easy after 12 or 13.
Why do we perceive certain ways of speaking as white or black in this country, regardless of where in the country folks might live?
Oh, it's fascinating. I mean, black people in this country came over as slave populations, as people that were brought over that did not speak English as their native tongue. They really had to develop what's first called a pidgin, which is really kind of an amalgamation of languages, little bits of English, but also little bits of their specific African languages. And they kind of got this mixed in order to communicate in the cotton fields and so on. Their children, however, create a Creole, which is closer to the surrounding English language, but also has other elements. I guess what I'm struggling to say is that really, because African-American populations have this kind of origin point, some little tiny frills and changes in vowels or little persistent things are in Black speech, as is argued by a wonderful linguist named John McWhorter, himself Black. But also, you know, I just talked a second ago about how people shape their language in order to distinguish themselves from others, from other populations. And this is something that also started to happen with Black English, as some people call it, or African-American vernacular. And you really had a sort of, you know, if I think if a people feel oppressed and feel unwelcome. They may not want to adopt when they move to the Great Lakes region with the great migration from the South after the First World War. They may not want to adopt the vowels like fiat in Ian. They may want to still say fatnin in a way that sounds more Southern. And there are other features and grammatical things in Black English. So this is the reason why we do hear, you know, it doesn't sort of matter where these Black populations settled after they moved up from the South. They can be way over in New York or they can be over in Michigan. But you will hear a certain similarity. And it's quite, quite fascinating, I think.
So I know you're actually Canadian by origin, so maybe you're the perfect person to ask this. Is there such a thing as a neutral American accent?
You know, you have to actually say no, there isn't, because we all have an accent. You know, there's sort of no way of saying there's sort of this absolute perfect way of speaking. Interestingly, that whole sort of middle section of the country, you know, the Midwest, they talk about a general American accent. And it feels and sounds very sort of uncolored, unshaded, you know, it doesn't sound like Bernie Sanders. It doesn't have certain features like no R on the ends of words, like caw, New York. You know, you get those R's carefully shaped. You get vowel sounds that sound, I guess, to our ears, neutral, but there's really nothing neutral about them. I think the reason they sound, you know, we call them neutral is because there's an awful lot of people that do speak that way across a vast geographic expanse. But I would also say that it's kind of a middle class way of speaking. And this is a country that, well, at least it used to have a very strong middle class that people wanted to belong to. And so in this sort of democratic sort of spirit of America, you know, this idea that there's a way of speaking that doesn't sound hoity-toity, you know, it's not like a British accent where there's kind of like the upper class accent, but also doesn't sound like, you know, the lower rungs of society, whatever those might sound like. It's kind of this middleness. And I think that's why we think of neutrality in that general American accent that, you know, news anchors all speak in.
Are we actually losing regional accents and dialects as people move to different parts of the country and we all consume similar sources of media?
Well, that's been the theory. It's been very much felt that particularly media, you know, that the idea that we all hear the same TV voices and now internet voices, that we are all sort of being smoothed together. William Labov, again, this linguist actually studies the sound of speech and has actually discovered that we're growing apart. Now, these are very subtle differences that are picked up with spectrographs and things that minutely parse the signal, but they do show that movement from fat to fiat to fiat and other changes in unbelievably, like in an unbelievable number of regions across the country. So these changes are actually taking place. Whether or not they will sort of continue and suddenly we end up with almost distinct languages across the continent seems unlikely, but certainly to a linguist's ear, you know, there's no way they would say that we're all being homogenized and that these accents are disappearing. There's actually more distinct accents. I think that's kind of stunning.
All right. The most famous speech givers in the modern era are politicians. Here is then Senator Barack Obama addressing the Democratic National Convention in 2004, which for a lot of Americans served as our introduction to him.
I stand here knowing that my story is part of the larger American story, that I owe a debt to all of those who came before me, and that in no other country on earth is my story even possible.
You say Obama has virtuosic control of his vocal instrument. I don't know if that was the very best example of it, but what do you hear when you listen to him speak that tells you he is gifted not just at crafting the words in speeches, but at delivering them?
Yeah, I hear a wonderful music. That speech ends up with him climactic claim that, you know, we're not a white America, a red America, a blue America, you know, we're the United States of America. And he does this declamatory rising crescendo. So he has a lot of music in his voice that is emotional, that moves us emotionally. But one of the things I stress in the book is that the best orators, this was Cicero's idea. The best speakers blend emotion and ideas, meaningful and necessary ideas. So the idea that Obama's expressing there is we've got to come together as the United States. He was so remarkable, and this is what I hear in his voice, is that his own voice was a living example of how everything can be brought together. He had a white mother and a black father. We're hearing a sort of a Midwestern general accent in him from his, I believe, Kansan mother. And so we're hearing that, but we're also hearing little bits of vowels that he picked up when he was living in East Harlem, for instance, as a student. So we're getting a lot of mixture in his voice, just on the level of vowels and consonants. And he also just is blessed with a lovely baritone and kind of a smooth tone. So it's just musically nice to listen to. So there's a lot happening in that voice that is sending a message of unity, togetherness, intelligence, and patience. All of Obama's speeches tended to be very intellectually interesting, historically learned, but all towards a single idea I discovered as I studied him more and more. The idea of unity really meant something to him. The idea that we are all created equal and that we must live together as a democracy of equals.
So I like doing this show, you know, mostly for the ideas, but I also find it really joyous to engage with different kinds of voices every day for an hour at a time. I really like the sound of your voice, but I know it's not the one you started adult life with. Have you come to terms with the way your voice sounds now?
I'm going to say I have, because I say that I have in the book, but there is no doubt. I mean, sometimes if my voice breaks up, it might have done so earlier when we were talking. You know, I do feel that little stab of, you know, and I am aware that I am working harder. I'll be a little more tired after this than someone else would be, because I literally am working harder with my abdominals and hip flexors and muscles in my back to drive the air past that sort of little burden that's on one of my vocal cords. I have a polyp. So, but I think the actual sound of it, the fact that it's got a rasp, I've told myself that, you know, all of our voices are kind of a roadmap to our history. They all have a patina, you know, and mine has a particular gruffness or roughness now that speaks to certain impulsive things I did, like singing too hard as a guy that was too old to do so. I mean, it's just who I am. I think that that's maybe okay. Yeah, so I guess I'm okay with it.
John Colapinto is a staff writer for The New Yorker and author of This Is the Voice. He joined us in February. Think is a production of KERA in Dallas. Our team includes Stephen Becker, Paige Phelps, Mia Estrada, Nilofer Arsala, and Micaela Rodriguez. Our interns are Angelica Perez, Tammy George, and Marissa Green. As always, I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.